Hi there, this is Richard Williams from the band Kansas, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hi, this is Phil Ehart, drummer for the band Kansas, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Hey, it's Dennis Dykin from the Smithereens here, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Episode 546 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host, John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, bringing the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 546 is kind of a big one. We're wrapping up the year, going out in style. Three great artists we have joining us from the band Kansas, vocalist Ronnie Platt. We also have violinist Ginny Luke, who is a solo artist, but also has performed with some of the biggest names in music. So we're going to talk to her about her great new solo album. But we're going to lead off the show with drummer Dennis Dykin of the band The Smithereens, who are coming in to do a show on the 18th at Jurgles. This is a special benefit for the Mario Lemieux Foundation. It's actually called X Out Cancer in conjunction with the X 1059. So Dennis was kind enough to take some time to talk to us. If you're familiar with the Smithereens, obviously had tremendous radio success in the 80s and early 90s. Just a few years ago, lost their original vocalist, Pat, passed away. So you ask yourself, okay, well, what's going on? How's this going to work? Well, if you haven't been following the band, Robin Wilson, who is the vocalist of the Gin Blossoms, who has been a guest on the show, has been serving up with vocal duties for the band The Smithereens for a number of years, so you'll get a chance to see them perform on the 18th and help out the Mario Lemieux Foundation as well. So we're going to play you a little bit of an album that may not have been on your radar. It was called The Lost Album from The Smithereens. It features Pat, the original vocalist, on vocals as well as songwriting credits, and Dennis and the rest of the band are involved as well. So I'm going to play you that, and then we're going to get into the interview with Dennis Dykin.
A knife in his back.
ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome to Iron City Rocks. We have from the Smithereens, Mr. Dennis Dykin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks so much for having me on.
It is an absolute pleasure. You guys are going to be rolling in to do a show on December 18th at Gerbils in Warrendale. It's benefiting the Mario Lemieux Foundation. And I think the first thing people might notice when they see is, you know, we all, you know, are aware of the tragic loss of Pat. And for those maybe who aren't as intimately familiar, you're performing with Robin Wilson of the Great Gin Blossoms on vocals. And I know he's been doing this for a while for you guys, but just for those maybe not familiar, how did you guys kind of start working with Robin?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. Yeah, Pat passed, it's hard to believe it, but on December 12th, it will be 7 years.
Yeah.
Just crazy to think that time has gone by so quickly, and I think back into onto that that point in time, and yeah, it was just we were shell shocked.
Mm-hmm.
So much that we at that moment we weren't sure how we were going to move forward, if we could move forward. That was December of 17, and in January of 18 we already had a gig booked at the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank, a great venue.
Mm-hmm.
And this show was being produced by Little Steven Van Zandt.
Yeah.
So his suggestion was that we keep the date, have the surviving Smithereens perform, and we would enlist, I don't know, somewhere between a dozen and 20 or more different singers to
mm-hmm.
join us that night, a tribute to Pat at this show. And there were just a bunch of very talented front people, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
And among them were Marshall Crenshaw, our old friend, who we knew since the early 80s, and Robin Wilson from Gin Blossoms, who we heard was a big fan of the band. And he sat in with us that night. I think he did two songs, maybe three, and it just felt right. You know, we were hoping that if we could find a vocalist who could interpret the music, not as a look-alike or a sound-alike, but somebody that could really embody the spirit of what we were doing, and if the audience would dig it, then we had a shot at moving forward, because we weren't going to give up no matter what. We've been doing this since we were kids. You know, Jimmy
yeah.
and Mike and I grew up together. So that's how we met Robin. He made it very clear to us that night that if asked, we'll serve. It turns out also that where he's from in the Tempe, Arizona area, the guys in Gin Blossoms and many other bands in that area were staunch Smithereens fans. So it was kind of a natural.
Yeah,
and it's a two-way street. We dig having him, and he really relishes playing with us.
Yeah, was there trepidation on your part or any of the guys in the band, even in Little Steven's suggestion? I think maybe the idea of doing like a celebration. A lot of bands have done things like that. The Allman Brothers, I can think of a great, you know, the Deepest End DVD from Government Mule, where they had different bassists sit in. Was that maybe an easier thing to commit to than to say, hey, we're gonna have somebody kind of step behind the mic for Pat in the long run?
Yeah, I think absolutely. It was the way it happened was just fortuitous, and also because literally within a month of Pat's passing, we didn't plan to do it. It just kind of, I guess you could say, fell into our laps, and it helped us ease the mourning process, and also just it just continued the energy. Might I add, that night in Red Bank, the audience, it was just packed to the rafters, and the love in that room and the support was overwhelming. It's a feeling and an evening we'll never forget. It sounds strange maybe to say this because Pat was not there, but it was one of the evenings ever for the Smithereens.
Yeah.
So I think the fact that it happened so quickly after Pat's passing made it a little different than some of the other tribute shows that have happened through the last so many years, where it was planned way in advance. This kind of just snapped into place, and it was really a different kind of experience. We were very lucky, actually.
Yeah, maybe
of course,
it was
Marshall does, but
maybe a help that you didn't have an opportunity to really think about it too long. You know, it's just kind of a, you know, you've got obviously logistics that go into a show, but you don't have a lot of time to process, you know, thinking about your feelings. You just got to go on autopilot and get ready to do the show.
Well, that's exactly, yeah.
Has the topic come up of doing new music, or is that kind of just not in the wheelhouse? I mean, obviously the business of music has changed since you guys started doing this in the 80s, and it's not as lucrative or even maybe necessary to tour. But is it something you guys think about doing?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we've started cutting some tracks. Jimmy and I have both been writing a lot, and we went into demo some ideas, but some of them came out real good. We might use them as master basics. We haven't finished anything yet, but we're going to resume that in the new year, and we're definitely going to have some new music coming out soon. Yeah, it's something we're very excited about.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, like you said, it's been 7 years, and it's sometimes musicians are like any other artist. Sometimes you just need to create, and obviously you've kept yourself extremely busy. Can you just touch on some of the musical projects that you've been involved with, you know, kind of aside from the Smithereens proper?
Well, currently I'm playing with James Mastro, who, from the Bongos. Some of your listeners might know of him. He has a solo album out right now called Dawn of a New Era, and it's a great band. We've been playing some shows. We're playing December 11th, as a matter of fact, at Bowery Electric in New York. But also, through the last 10 or so many years, I'm losing count, I was fortunate enough to play with the late, great Ronnie Spector for quite a while. Who was and that was a stone gas for a number of reasons. Well, because I grew up listening to her music, and I really learned to play in large part from listening to Hal Blaine and Earl Palmer playing on the Phil Spector productions.
Right.
So it was like being a kid and playing along with my favorite records. But the other thing, it was a great band too. But the other thing is that Ronnie, up until the very end, was the real deal. She never resorted to the, in my time with her, she wasn't an oldies act.
Right.
You know, he was still vital and exciting and was doing new material. And so that was just such a special period in my life to be able to play with her. Every time I stepped on the drum stool, up to the drum stool, I never took it for granted. And I felt the same way playing with Dave Davies of the Kinks.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about childhood heroes.
You really got me
when it first came out. And those records really, throughout their career, the Kinks loomed so large, mostly through the 70s, I would say, in the Smithereens world. We just worshipped them and went to see them so many times. So anyway, getting a chance to play with Dave and getting to know him and spending time on the road playing and hanging with him was such a thrill. And I often describe Dave at this point in his life. He's still a punk, which I love, but he's got the wisdom of an old sage. So I learned a lot playing with Dave, you know, just about life, and it was great to be in his aura.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about two just, you know, nebulas of music, and it's kind of neat because it's very different style even than, you know, I think maybe when you think of the Smithereens kind of music, and then you think of Ronnie, the Ronettes, you know, and even the Kinks, you know, it's not necessarily the exact same kind of stuff. So it's really cool to see your talents on display in different types of music. Is that something you enjoy? I think people, you get an idea, you know, he's a, you know, alt rock drummer, or, you know, you're a metal drummer, or you're that. But is it important to you to kind of flex those different genres of music? You know, because musicians aren't one, you know, at the end of the day, aren't really boxed in by their success.
It is very important to me. Yeah, I grew up listening to so many different kinds of music. I was blessed to have mentors in my life that pointed the way towards certain music. A fellow, actually a guy who lives in Pennsylvania, Bobby Zeiss, when I was a kid, great drummer in Carteret, New Jersey, that showed me the ropes. And but also, there was great radio growing up in the late 60s, early 70s. New York City had such varied programming, freeform programming, stations like WFMU, which is still a mainstay. So I learned a lot, and I gravitated towards all different kind of music. And I always wanted to be able to play different styles, even if I'm faking it, which a lot of drummers do, or a lot of musicians do. You get thrown into a situation, and you just go for it. But if you had enough training, I never had formal training, but I listened to, I devoured so many different styles listening to records. It was important to me to be able to go all those different routes. And any different style you play always informs whatever you're doing at that particular gig. You know what I'm saying?
It's, yeah.
You're like a singer-songwriter thing. It still comes, what you're doing in a softer vein, perhaps, still makes you think a different way and broadens you. So, yeah, I love playing different kinds of music, and there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned about radio. You know, I was thinking about that when you mentioned Little Steven, because his station, and I know Pat was real instrumental in Sirius XM's kind of development to get the exposure to that kind of stuff, because, you know, terrestrial radio is a lot of times the playlists are so sterile. Especially when you get outside of, you know, the area where you're talking about, New York, you know, out here where we're at radio stations, you can almost guess what song you're going to hear when you turn it on. So it's really kind of a shame. And then, you know, you go to the other extreme with the internet, and there's so much at your fingertips sometimes that it's overwhelming to know where to start.
Yep.
So sometimes I don't think the world gives the credit to some of the disc jockeys of some of these stations and program directors that help shape, you know, especially in the 60s and the 70s, really gave that exposure to people. One question I always wondered, because I remember very distinctly, you know, like kind of the late 80s when really the album 11 kind of exploded. Girl Like You was everywhere. Were you guys, when you put that song to tape, I assume at that point, did you sense you had that big of a hit? I mean, you know, obviously you guys kind of know what a hit sounds like. Did you guys get that sense with that song, or did it catch even you by surprise?
You know what? I think we did. I think we felt that we captured something in that recording that was special. You know, and when you're in the studio, sometimes you do smell the hit. And I think you could release a record you really believe in, and it could go no.
You know,
it depends who you're up against, or perhaps the sac did not produce the sufficient bulge when delivered to whoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the 80s, yes.
Yeah, so you never know for sure, but we felt that no matter what, we were doing something worthwhile with that cut, and we thought it could be a hit, yeah.
Was it, you know, when you, like you said, were there other songs that you had up to that point where you thought maybe that was going to be a hit that didn't, you know, for whatever reason? Were there songs, you know what I mean, that maybe resonated with the guys in the band, but maybe not the fans, or is it?
Yeah, to answer your question, matter of fact, our first album, Especially For You, which came out in 86, it had two pretty sizable numbers for us in Behind the Wall of Sleep and Blood and Roses. And Blood and Roses was the first. There's a whole story behind that. Yeah. And how that selected as a single, but we never regarded that as single material. We thought the obvious choice for the first single from that album would have been the lead-off track, Strangers When We Meet. We thought it fell more in line with what we thought was a classic top 40 pop sound from when we were growing up. It had a really strong hook and had the good beat that you could dance to and all that, but it turned out that even though I think we might have serviced that to radio towards the end, that just fell by the wayside, and the songs that we did not regard as highly as single material did really well for us. So it does happen.
It's kind of a crapshoot in some respects. A Girl Like You, I believe, and if the lore is incorrect, please let us know, but was in consideration for the movie Say Anything. Was that actually true? And what were your, like, were you guys involved in any way with that negotiation of that? Or is that handled by accountants and lawyers more so than the four of you were?
In particular, that incident, Pat was getting to be chummy with Cameron Crowe,
okay,
who was working on that. And Pat was actually commissioned to write that song for the film.
Okay.
And when he submitted it, they felt that it gave away, the lyrics gave away too much of the plot line.
Okay.
So it did okay anyway, so it was a win-win,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah, I was actually thinking if it had been on that soundtrack, which was a fantastic soundtrack, though, you're fighting with Peter Gabriel in that case, and you know, for what's the most important song in the film, and that's probably not a advantageous. So you may have done better, you're just making it the lead cut from the album and go that direction, because that was obviously in your eyes was, you know, synonymous with that film. So maybe fate had it.
Yeah.
Had,
yeah, I think you're right. And also, I think that another film company wanted to use or asked to use that song for the movie Roadhouse. Was that around the same time? I think it was.
Yeah.
And we declined because at that point we felt that we had a hit, and the label felt we had a hit. This was after it was already mixed and the album might have even been out. I forget. So we declined, and kind of glad about that, too.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to that movie. Certainly a different movie as far as plot and everything. And to be honest with you, I mean, I think, you know, for example, Jeff Healey had done some work on that soundtrack. It kind of fit maybe a little more of the vibe of the film than your single would have. So I think maybe destiny shined on you guys, and it just lined up perfectly for you. Well, Dennis, I want to thank you again. You guys are going to be in on the 18th to do this cancer benefit for the Mary LMU Foundation at Jurgles. We'll be excited to see Robin Wilson on vocals, and just so glad that you guys are keeping the music alive and moving the band forward. And I want to thank you so much. Wish you safe travel, and if I don't get a chance to talk to you, happy holidays.
Thanks a lot, and I really do appreciate your time and everybody's time. We could not have been doing this for what will be 45 years in March of next year if it wasn't for the love and support from the people that keep coming out to see us. And they're really great folks and great fans. And thank you, and thanks to everybody out there in Radio Land.
All right, a big thank you to Dennis Syke. And again, that will be the X Out Cancer Benefit at Jurgles on the 18th of December, benefiting the Mary Lemieux Foundation. Be a fantastic night. So many great hits from the Smithereens. Saw somebody ridiculously comment on social media that they had one song, and obviously somebody who never did anything but listen to mainstream radio, because they're a fantastic number of songs. Going to turn our attention now to a band that are wrapping up their 2024 tour, their 50th anniversary tour, I should even say. More importantly, the Another Fork in the Road Tour Kansas will be wrapping it up with a huge show at the Benedum Center on the 11th. That's this Wednesday. If you're listening to this, that's either today, tomorrow, or maybe 2 days from now. So You want to act fast if you want to go to that show. We are joined by Ronnie Platt, who's been the vocalist since 2016. Interesting to get a chance to talk to him because he was in a situation where he was stepping in for Steve Walsh after he retired. Just decided he didn't want to do it anymore, which is a different situation. You know, many bands, the Smithereens, as we mentioned, the passing of their original singer. A lot of bands just can't get along with their singers, but Kansas is a very different situation. You know, a lot of artists of this generation, you're not getting any younger. Certain instruments are much more physical. We just saw Nico McBrain of Iron Maiden deciding he wants to retire and enjoy his time away from the madness. So it's totally understandable, and it was interesting to get a chance to talk to Ronnie about what that experience is like when you're stepping in an amicable situation. You know, so many lead singer replacements are so contentious that it was nice to kind of pick his brain. Again, this show is December 11th, so if you're listening to this, you probably want to be ordering tickets as you're listening to the interview. So we're going to play you a little bit of Ronnie fronting Kansas from the Prelude Implicit album, and then we're going to get into that interview.
Feel the vibration.
Platt of Kansas on the line. How are you doing today, Ronnie?
Absolutely fantastic, John. How are things where you're at?
I'm doing very, very well. You guys are going to be coming in to Pittsburgh in just a tiny bit over a month to do a show at the Bennett on the final night of the 50th anniversary tour here in Pittsburgh, which, if I'm not mistaken, them thinking back, this may have been where it started or very close to, because I think we had you guys earlier in this tour. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, you guys are in the midst of it right now, how this show's been going, how the crowds have been reacting to 50 years of Kansas?
Well, John, we must be doing something right because we've extended this tour not once but twice. The audience response has been just over the top fantastic, and we're loving every second of it. And it's kind of sad that this tour is going to come to a close with it, Pittsburgh being the last show.
Yeah, I'm looking at your itinerary, though, and you guys only have about a month till you're back out at in January doing some dates. But, yeah, it is. It's the tours go by so fast. I'm sure while you're day-to-day in the tour, it's probably like, boy, I'd like to get home. I'd like to unpack, do some laundry. But when it's over, I'm sure it's kind of like,
you know my life all too well.
Yeah, yeah. Reintroduce yourself to the dog.
But hey, who's this guy sitting on my couch?
Yeah, he's not allowed in here. But it's funny because I was looking back and I'm like, yeah, you've been in this band now for a number of years now, but I think people still think of you as like the new guy. Does it seem like it's been that long? I mean, you're to the point of like, probably getting a pension from these guys at this point. does the time go as fast for you as it feels like it went for us?
John, I couldn't tell you where the last 10 years went. I mean, I've been in the band now more than a decade, 10 and a half years, and it's still surreal to me. And it's so wild to be looking at our upcoming gig list and be thinking, that's 5 months or 6 months off yet. You know, that's a lot of time between now and then. And then you get to that gig, and it's like, where did the time go?
Yeah.
And I have to check with JR, but I believe I've surpassed 700 shows now.
Wow.
With Kansas. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, and you throw in that period of time of pandemic, which you guys obviously weren't doing. You know, we weren't doing 100 dates that year, or 2 years probably. You know,
everybody didn't even see each other for 13 months.
Yeah, then you had to realize what it was like to live back at home, and then, you know, it's a little become a regular civilian. But yeah, it's amazing to look at that. You know, when you think about, you know, the span of time when people think about kind of the golden age of Kansas, it, you know, probably wasn't even 10 years in duration. But then you look back, you're like, you've been the singer of this band for 10 years, so it's a really cool thing. In the last, is it my imagination? I've been to many shows post-COVID, and you've performed many, many shows post-COVID, that audiences just seem to really revel in live music more now than they did like 5 years ago?
You know, it's funny that you say that, and I look at it from that perspective, and it really does. It really seems like there's a bigger appreciation now for live music. And if you were to judge it by our audience, you would agree.
Yeah.
Because it seems like there's an intensity level, mm-hmm, of appreciation for not only the us, but, you know, I've gone and I've seen other acts, and, you know, I've gone to other shows, and I've witnessed the same thing. So it was like, you know, the pandemic took something away. And then after the pandemic, it came back, and, you know, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel that that is the case with live music, because, boy, it really seems like there's such an intensity level. And it's great because the band feeds off that. you know, the band feeds off the audience and the audience feeds off the band. And it really seems like it's taken a step up since then.
You're in a bit of a unique situation, and I can't tell you in the 15 plus years we've been doing this how many singers we've spoken to who are kind of the replacement, for maybe lack of a better word. But your situation is very unique in that Steve decided to retire. This wasn't there was no court cases and fighting. He just decided that was enough. Did that in a way make this transition for you? I mean, that's been 10 years now, but for you a little bit easier as a musician to step into that role, as opposed to, you know, had, you know, Rich and Steve been embroiled in a lawsuit and you had two versions of Kansas traveling the world? Was this a little bit smoother transition, and were the fans a little more receptive because of that?
Absolutely. I think Steve struggled for a few years, and to do it as long as Steve did it as a singer, it's different for a singer. And just, you know, I run the analogy of comparing it to like an NFL player.
Yeah.
You know, a kicker is going to last, you know, in the NFL a lot longer than a running back. You know, the lifespan of a running back might be 5 years. The lifespan of a kicker might be, you know, 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
It's a different demand on your body. And for Steve to do this as long as he did, he deserves a well-earned retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And it did make the transition extremely easy. And, you know, it's something you bring up, replacement singers. I know that I belong to a very exclusive club.
Mm-hmm.
for bands from my era.
Yeah.
You know, I think of Lawrence Gowan,
who
took Young's place in Styx, Tommy DiCarlo, who took Brad Delp's place in Boston, Arnell in Journey, Kelly Hansen in Foreigner. You know, for bands to have that kind of name recognition and have replacement singers, it's a very, very small, tight-knit group, and it's just seemed to work so well for every band that I mentioned.
Yeah,
you know, still came out and you know, we're selling out sheds and still doing great with the replacement singers, whereas it only goes to prove that it's about the music and not the personnel in the band.
Yeah. I think it has to help in a case like yourself, and you mentioned Tommy DiCarlo, who is another great example, where your situations, in a way, are very similar in that people can look at what you do and say, Ronnie's keeping the music of Kansas alive. You know, Tommy was doing that. Had no one stepped into Steve's role or Brad's role, those bands would have just faded away, you know, be somebody ahead. Where people, I think, still harbor, deservedly or so or not, but Arnell, Kelly, are looked at as, you know, they're taking the role of somebody we'd love to see come back and do it again. You know, I think the whole world, you know, would probably jump at the chance to see Steve Perry front Journey again. I don't think that, you know, this has been as long as I remember music. You know, you wanted David Lee Roth back in Van Halen. No slight to Sammy Hagar, but there's always that, you know, longing for the fan to see the classic lineup. You know, and I think Foreigner's done an exceptional job of including their legacy of members, you know, along the way. But still, I think there's probably a small percentage that say, you know, I want to see Lou Graham. That's the voice of Foreigner. Although you'd be hard pressed sometimes to tell the difference with Kelly. He does such an amazing job. But you guys don't have that built in sort of, you know, you know, when Steve decided he wanted to retire, and I think everyone agrees after 40 plus years, he's earned it. You know, Brad, obviously, we know the situation there. So people aren't clamoring for that. It probably makes that transition for you a little bit smoother. But I was curious, you know, how that is, because you're in a bit of a unique situation where the other singer isn't out there doing something competing with you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Steve is just totally has retired from music.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Did
it help? You know, when you guys, you know, from a musician standpoint, because you're a musician, and I think everybody, you didn't just step off, you know, out of the sky and fill this job and certainly suddenly learn how to sing. But when you get to go in, and you guys have done a few studio albums now to help kind of cement, you know, your voice as part of the Kansas legacy, does that even help further?
Oh, I think it does immensely, because, you know, we're not just, you know, beating to death, you know, Dust in the Wind and Wayward Son and No Return. It's always been the work ethic of Kansas to constantly produce new music.
Mm-hmm.
And even though when you look at the past members of this band and how the band has just evolved, and the style might have changed a little bit through the years, but mm-hmm. it's still unmistakably Kansas.
Yeah.
You know, and I think everyone that's been in the band post the six original members, we were all so influenced by Kansas growing up and you know, honing our craft along with Kansas music, that even when we're out, when we're writing something on our own, it subliminally has an element of Kansas in it, because you're a product of your influences. And yeah. I mean, for me, it was, you know, Kansas and the prog rock bands and the great singers. It was, you know, Kansas and Yes and Genesis and Rush. But, you know, then the singers that influenced me, everyone we just mentioned, you know, Steve Walsh, Steve Perry, Lou Graham, so many singers that influenced me. And you become a product of your influences, and that really comes out in Kansas music, and it really is a chemistry.
Yeah.
And boy, what an exciting time to get into the band and then talk to Phil and do a new album.
Yeah.
Have two studio albums now, and then three live albums just since I've been in the band. It's just two live albums and a compilation album.
Sure.
It really does give validity to the new members.
Yeah, I think that always helps to make a statement. And let me ask you this: when you go, okay, you kind of rewind time to, if you can recall, I'm sure you recall your first gig with the band versus your first trip into the studio. Which one would you say was a little more nerve-wracking? I have to assume both of them probably, you know, were butterflies. But, you know, when you make that album, you are stepping into an indelible legacy of recorded music with the band. So, I mean, that's one piece. You walk out on stage, it's a whole different animal. Was there one that you think was a bigger, you know, bigger set of butterflies than the other?
Well, Phil Lehart helped me with in the studio when we first started recording Prelude, and the first song we did was a song I wrote lyrics for, With This Heart. And, you know, I was in the band a while at that point when we started recording that album. So were my butterflies bigger, my first show or my first trip in the studio? Well, it's two different environments.
Sure.
So it's hard to judge, but being in the studio, I'm about to do my first vocal track, and, you know, Phil comes into the recording room, and, you know, we're talking, and he looks at me and goes, "Now listen, just have fun with this, relax, give it your best shot, and just totally put it out of your mind that there's 2.6 million Kansas fans waiting for this right now." Gee, thanks,
yeah,
Phil.
That
relaxed me.
I was thinking, you know,
It was pretty funny, but it did bring my adrenaline level up a few points.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, as I was asking the question, I'm like, is it more intimidating to look out at a, you know, 10,000 Kansas fans in a venue, or Phil and Rich on the other side of the glass? You know, that's great. To set the bar high with the 2.6 million.
You know, and after they revived me with the defibrillator and I did my first vocal, I was fine.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great story there. So let's talk a little bit about your 50th anniversary tour. I think there are certain songs that you know, obviously, if Kansas doesn't play, you know, and there's quite a few songs that really fit in this category, you know, there would be a riot, you know, play Song for America or, you know, whatever. But do you guys get to put some kind of Easter egg songs in the set list, or is it to the point now where, you know, it's got to be this way, or, you know, they're not going to let us out of the building? Do you have a lot of freedom as far as what you can play in a night, or is it pretty locked in?
We're pretty locked in, and it's something that this music really confines you in that respect, mm-hmm. because, you know, this isn't the kind of music that you can just pull out of your hat and play the song.
Sure.
And it's such intense, layered music. It really takes a lot to learn new songs and get them to that level. I mean, there's the learning process, there's the polishing process, but then there's also the process of playing that song in front of an audience. It's every time you're stepping it up. And this band, even tonight and even December 11th, when we've been doing this show for such a long time now, we're still going to go in and have our rehearsal room set up before the show and be tweaking things. This band rehearses every show. And, you know, we are our own worst critics. You know, and it's really funny to, you know, walk off the stage after Wayward Son and just hear the audience losing their mind. Mm-hmm. But yet we're walking back and it's like, oh man, I made a mistake in this song and I messed up this song. And, you know, something that the audience would never, ever be able to pick out.
Yeah.
And it's just that level of quality that we impose on ourselves.
Yeah.
So interchanging songs, you know, is a difficult thing when you're already doing a, you know, 2-hour and 10-minute long show of really, really super intense music. You know, I mean, Dust in the Wind might sound like a simple song, but to, you know, sync the three guitars, you know, we got Rich playing guitar, we got Dan playing guitar, and Zach is playing guitar on Dust in the Wind, but they're playing different inversions of the chord, and to sync that together, you know, it's intense.
Yeah.
You know, and then you mentioned Song for America. I mean, that is just, you're paying attention. I mean, when I'm playing that and singing that song and playing it, I have such intense tunnel vision. There is absolutely nothing else I'm thinking about but the next phrase.
Yeah.
So it's tough. This music is not easy, folks. I'll tell you, it's not easy.
You're not doing the garage rock 1-4-5 chord progression, you know, with four on the floor and let's go. You know, you don't drop these songs casually.
But on the other hand, I have to tell you, you know, night after night we've been pulling it off, and just the level of gratification playing this stuff. And just the gratification is just off the charts. To, you know, come to the end of the show and just, wow, we did it again. You know, it really is it's a relief, but a rewarding relief.
Yeah.
And we love it. I mean, it's intoxicating.
And I think for the fans too, I mean, the product that you guys put forward is really, there aren't many bands out there with the musicianship that can do this kind of stuff, you know, in the touring world without, you know, if you guys were in your 20s, I would expect 70% of your set to be backing tracks, quite honestly, at this point, because of, you know, that's just the way, you know, everything is so synchronized. So, you know, to see a band that puts in the work. You mentioned rehearsing for every show. You know, there's probably some bands out there that don't rehearse for a tour. You know, they just make sure they're in, you know, the right place for the flash pot. The video screens look pretty. You know, the tape doesn't get stuck. So it's, you know, as a fan, I think people appreciate that there just aren't that many bands that can do what you guys do. And it's important, I think, to put you guys in and give the band the due as a progressive band, I think, because, you know, sometimes I think people think of Kansas and might lump you in more with a southern rock, which isn't unfair, but you certainly belong in the conversation with the Rushes and the Genesis and Pink Floyd and you know, some of the Yes, King Crimson, for the musicality.
Absolutely. I agree.
Ronnie, I want to thank you so much for your time. Again, you're going to be here December 11th to bring this 50th anniversary, and you guys can start probably would be the 52nd anniversary tour about a day or two later. But I want to thank you so much, and we look so forward to seeing you here in Pittsburgh. I know you guys have had a great relationship with DeCesar Engler over the years, and Rich is bringing you guys in, so it'll be fantastic to see you guys playing the beautiful Benedum Theater right before Christmas, and you guys can get home and get settled in and have a nice holiday. So thank you so much.
Yeah, it's going to be mixed emotions to think that this is going to be the last time we're going to play this 50th anniversary show. We're so excited about it, and it's going to be over the top. But when it's over with, it's going to be disappointing. Not disappointing, but you know, sad to end a tour that we've had such a great response on, and that we've just made so many people happy. We get to go into the holidays carrying that feeling of satisfaction with us.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a great way to bring 2024 to a close, and look forward to, you know, some new material, hopefully, and some many, many more trips through Pittsburgh in the future, man. So thank you so much.
John, thank you so much.
All right, don't miss Kansas, December 11th, Benedum Center, the end of their 50th anniversary tour. Great chance to see them before you go into the holidays. Be an amazing night of music. I want to thank Ronnie Platt so much for taking the time to join us and talk about that show. I'm going to turn our attention now to a musician who came on our radar simply by the fact, quite honestly, that she was performing with Orianthe. And I was like, okay, this is going to be worth listening to if Orianthe is going to lend her time to this project. And the artist's name is Ginny Luke. She's got a new album called Devil at My Heels. Ginny has got a resume as long as my arm. She's obviously an electric violinist, as I mentioned. She has performed with the likes of Dave Matthews, Snoop Dogg, the Foo Fighters, Nicki Minaj, Meatloaf. The list goes on and on forever. So an amazing musician. Also, she worked with Nellie Brosh, who was on our show. Both Nellie and her brother, Ethan, have been on our show in the past, a great musical family. So the pedigree that she has worked with has just been amazing. So it was worth the time to take the chance to listen to her. And then I listened to her and I was like, okay, this is amazing. So we're going to play a little bit of her music. This is Ginny Luke. This is a song. This is the title track of the album called Devil at My Heels. And then we are going to get into that. City Rocks, we have on the line Ginny Luke. How are you doing today, Ginny?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, John.
It is absolutely my pleasure. You have just dropped a fantastic new record that I have to admit I'm having a hard time trying to categorize Devil at My Heels, because it's got elements of hard rock. I can feel some pop in it. So it really, I think, has got a wide breadth to the types of music. How would you, if you were sticking this in a category, where would you put your record?
I call it Bad Bitch Electric Violin Vocal Power Record.
I'm looking for that section in the store. It would be you, and I'm trying to think who else would even fit in that. If you left the bitch out, we could have put maybe Roddy Chung in there as well, but it's a very limited category.
Yeah, he's awesome.
But you have been doing music for a while, and I know you had an EP, but what kind of sparked this, you know, full on. I mean, this is, you know, this isn't just an indie kind of release. This has got, you know, all the earmarks. You've got fantastic guests. What kind of got this particular project rolling?
I wanted to do a full album and was prepared to do one back in 2019 and work with Blue Alon then, and then the pandemic struck. During the time, I continued to produce records and make demos and not release them. And then when the pandemic ended, we moved forward with signing with KZZ and Blue Alon Records. And I knew I wanted to put a body of work out since my EP release over 10 years ago.
Right.
And I had dropped singles since, and we're in a singles market, but this body of work is a cohesive statement and a sonic signature of Ginny Luke. So I knew I just really wanted to get that put out into the world to make my mark and make my statement musically.
Yeah, and looking at, you know, the musicians you've played with, I mean, you don't have to look far down that list to see Stevie Wonder, David Foster. So it isn't, I don't think anybody who would look at that resume would say, you know, she needs to prove herself. But I imagine as a musician, it's got to be very liberating to kind of step out of the shadows. Is that a true statement?
Yeah. Sure. I think of it as having contributed to so many artists' universes and their visions, and so now I get to express my vision and create my artistic universe. I learned so much from the greats, and I still get to work with so many great musicians, and that informs my musicality, my musicianship, my artistry. And I feel like I wasn't fully in the shadows, but I was sharing the stage oftentimes in these big artist bands. So I feel excited to be embarking on my solo trajectory.
Did you always have kind of a sense of where you wanted the music to go directionally, or is that something that you kind of had to give some thought to? I mean, you know, I certainly sense when I listen to the music that it's got a real sense of power and self to it. But do you give that a lot of thought, or is this just kind of where the writing process naturally takes you?
I give a lot of thought, I guess, to the feeling I wanted to create and the electric violin tone and the vocal tones I wanted to use. And through my experiences through my 20s, that dictated the song subject matter. And yeah, I was pretty intentional about wanting to make a record with Bad Bitch Rock with strings.
Yeah.
Because that's very much who I am, and it's kind of my rebellious phase as well.
Sure.
Coming out of my, like, late teens and having to adhere to all these societal and family rules about how to be a lady, and then kind of wanting to break them a lot with this record and my sound and my statement. So, yeah, it was thought out, but it also was kind of intuitive.
Was some of the, you mentioned you being a female and the norms that are kind of imposed. Does the instrument itself kind of lend itself to that? Because, I mean, when you think of the violin, obviously you have, especially for the average person, has kind of an idea. You're either playing country music and doing maybe a Charlie Daniels type of thing, or you're doing maybe, you know, the Trans-Siberian Orchestra kind of thing, two cellos. Was it kind of rethinking where the violin fits in music to a degree?
Yes. Totally. The violin, especially growing up, was always something that had to be beautiful and had to be obedient in many ways. You're obedient to conductors, you're obedient to your teachers, you're obedient to the composers who write for the instrument. And I was always longing to be like a lead guitar player.
Yeah. Yeah.
People don't boss lead guitar players around.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be a lead guitar player, you have to really own it. And, you know, you get to own the stage and you own your sound and people admire you for that. So absolutely, I think the violin has always been perceived as less, not less powerful, but more pleasing. I think that's the word. So I wanted to break that. I wanted to break that perception. And I still love exploring tones and performance styles that are beautiful. But I also want the sonic ability to have a gruff or a badass gritty tone, and I want to be able to move that way on stage if I feel like it. So I just want more freedom for expression on the instrument, and I think we're starting to get there with some of the electric violinists and electric string players in our current music generation now. It's just starting, though.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really stuck out to me when I listened to your cover of Deep Purple Mock, whatever that is for, Burn, you know, that you didn't just mimic the guitar solo. It was, you know, you put your own spin on it. And as an instrument, you almost didn't know what to expect. You know, I hear the guitars, you know, I heard Burn 1,000 times, and you kind of have an expectation of what the song is going to sound like. And I'm like, I don't know how this is going to sound, quite honestly, you know, when the guitars get rolling. And then the solo came in. I was like, yeah, this tonally to your ear really does work. I mean, you know, it's certainly not mistakeable that it's a violin versus a guitar, but it's not, you know, part of a string quartet playing background music where, you know, violins tend to be in rock. You were right out there, just kick the door in and go. You don't hear that, you know, and I think that's really, I think, expanding people's perception. You know, I think of, you know, again, dumb music fan that I might be, you think of violin solos, I don't go far past Charlie Daniels, you know, for obviously maybe one of the greatest solos ever, but there aren't a lot of other comparisons for what you're doing. Looking at all the folks you've played with over the years, is there anyone in particular that you maybe learned something from, that even maybe not even the biggest name on the list, because it's hard to categorize, even some of the names on your list are so big, but somebody that really influenced you in a way that caught you off guard and maybe took you in a direction you didn't expect?
A big name or any artist?
Any name. Actually, it would be more interesting if it wasn't a big name. That's, you know, looking at some of the people on here, you could tell, you know, maybe they're a little more intimidating to kind of go out on a limb musically with somebody who is as iconic as Stevie Wonder, but maybe somebody you've worked with who's really helped shape you into the musician you are.
Oh, yeah, let me think. Oh, well, I think the clearest, obvious answer for me, and I'll give more of a behind-the-scenes name, and then I'll give a big name. My mentor, Henri Gill, he was the music director for Alicia Keys for 14 years. He worked with John Mayer live and in studio. He also worked with Stevie Wonder. I think he's out on tour with Stevie Wonder right now again. Mm-hmm. Henri Gill is my biggest musical supporter in my life. He is the best musician I know personally. He has created so many artists' sounds, not just those artists, also Backstreet Boys tour, many, many other artists. Will.i.am, he works deeply and closely, and Britney Spears. We did the Britney Jean album record together. Henri is the biggest musical influence on me because he's multifaceted in styles of music. He is a high, high, high level musician who knows how to simplify to make a great record and how to make great tour arrangements. And he's a kind person. He's a straightforward person. So all of those things have influenced me since I was 21 when I met him to be the person I am. And I actually studied him on the Alicia Keys DVDs and live recordings, since I believe that DVD specifically of the MTV Unplugged came out when I was about 14 or 15.
Okay.
And then the different tour arrangements. So I actually knew his music before, or his arrangements before I got to meet him in person. And then when I met him and started recording on all these different records with him, I couldn't believe it was like full circle. I already knew so much of his work. So that would be the answer of like, not a commercial artist name, but the person who orchestrates behind it.
Sure.
And my other name I wanted to share would be Dave Matthews. I got to work with him and his band when I was 18 years old, I think, for the You and Me video.
Okay.
And he was so kind. Oh my gosh, he and the whole band were so kind. And his trumpet player, Rashawn, I ended up being around, and I think we might have done one gig together in my 20s. Rashawn is super kind, but Dave Matthews, like the way he leads his band and leads his career, just with so much grace and authority and cool, unique musicianship, that was a big influence on me too.
Yeah. I guess the one theme, you use the word kind and grace, and those are unicorns sometimes in this business. You know, you think of some artists that, you know, someone like a Dave Matthews who could easily just be a prima donna. It's always wonderful when people exceed the expectation you have for them. Because I'm sure you've run into the opposite, and we don't need to get into that. But, you know, it's refreshing to hear. When you were putting your record together, you obviously were joined by Orianthe and phenomenal Nili Brosh. How did those collaborations come up? Would you just kind of put out a call to some people you've worked in the past, or did you seek out, you know, I'm a big fan of this record or that record, I'd like to get her? Was it, how do those kind of pairings come up?
It was the latter. Yeah, my leader of the record label, I don't know if I should call him supporter, president of the record label, Kirk Passage.
Mm-hmm.
He is the person who signed me and who encouraged me to make this record. And he said, if you could have a guest on the record, who would you have? And I said, Orianthe, because I've loved her and studied her music and her career, her guitar playing, her voice, since I was 16 years old. And I love her style. She's so fierce, and she graciously agreed to play on Devil at My Heels when the label reached out to her, and that was so cool. I was like, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
And she just played amazingly on it. She made it a fire track, you know?
Yeah.
And then Nili Brosh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, Nili certainly a different guitarist, but I'd be curious how you ended up working with her as well.
Yeah, Nili is one of the strongest, I would say newest, fierce guitar players that I became aware of. Strong woman, high level musician as well. And so I was brainstorming who would kill that solo on Burn, and talking to some colleagues about the best female guitar players, and her name came up, and I got familiar with her work, and then the label reached out to her again, and she also kindly said yes, and then I got to get to know her a little bit in these last couple months. She's such a cool girl and cool leader in the music industry.
Yeah, such a genuine person. And I wonder what's in the Brosh family genes. Her brother, obviously no slouch on the instrument either. They must have some fun family get-togethers with the talent.
Yeah.
When you do, with the album release, I know you're doing a show coming up in New York. Do you have like a plan to tour with this, or what's next for you?
I would love to tour the album, but as you know, the climate for artist touring is very challenging right now. So I don't have any tour dates on the books at the moment, although I'm working with booking agents to look at different cities, different markets. It's very possible I might tour the record. I'll probably start in the Midwest because that's where I'm from.
Sure.
And that's where like a big part of the fan base is. I think promo dates and online engagement is what artists right now are focusing so much on, because if you're not profiting on the road, there's no reason to go on the road. So I'm really trying to connect with fans through online engagement right now.
When it comes to music like this, is there opportunities for artists such as yourself for like instrument endorsements? You know, when I look at this, I think, you know, there's a, you know, this music screams out to another generation of potential, you know, violinists who might be looking at this and go, wow, this is really something that inspires them. Is there a market for that, like there is for guitars? I mean, it seems like, you know, anybody with an album has a signature edition somewhere.
I do work with companies and have endorsements with Glasser Violins.
Okay.
They have been wonderful to me. They provided me multiple violins on the AJR arena tour I was on over the summer. I also have endorsements with Line 6. They provided the Helix, which is an amazing pedal board. Multi-effect processor. I have endorsements with PV amplifiers, PV Electronics. So I have their Nashville amp. I have their wireless system, which is amazing. It works internationally. Let's see. I've had many other company collaborations and endorsements in the past. Some of them I still go back to, like Pigtronic. They've been very supportive since I was 18, 19 years old. I have videos coming out promoting their products. There's one that just came out. There's lots of collaboration and I would say community there. I appreciate the companies that support artists like myself so much. I can't even say how much that makes a difference. Like PV and previously Fender, like in my early 20s, they just supported me so much, like with marketing, with showcases, with advertising and billboards, magazines, like that helps artists so much. So yeah, there's lots of
opportunities. As far as, this is maybe a kind of a nerdy question, but you mentioned the Line 6 Helix. For a violin, is it capable of just going through a guitar amp, or do you have different, like a line for a violin? Because I would assume it goes higher tonally than a guitar, but maybe that's my ignorance.
You're right, it does. And I still find guitar amps, and this is really funny, bass amps. Bass amps, like my Trace Elliott amp that is a sister company of PV, it has a frequency spectrum, so you can set preferences on what frequencies get boosted.
Okay.
But that bass amp is so warm on violin, and coincidentally, Stevie Wonder also used it for, I think for his keyboard, but I'm not sure what he used that amp for. So don't quote me on that, but he also used that amp. And that amp just sounds so good on electric and acoustic violin. Guitar amps sound great too. So the one I'm using from PV right now, the Nashville amp, it works for pedal steel and guitar, and then they said, well, we think this will work for fiddle, and it sounds so good on violin.
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking about that, and like you get into issues with size of speakers and things like that. I'm like, I don't know exactly where this would fit. I wasn't sure if you had to use more of a traditional keyboard amp because of the wider number of octaves it's kind of designed for, or do you use like guitar effects as well then?
Yeah, I use guitar effects, and I also use the settings on the amp I have used keyboard amps, but they never sound as good as guitar and bass amps, I noticed.
Yeah, it's kind of a, they're kind of designed for what they're designed for, but that's really cool. I thank you for indulging that question, because that would have haunted me. Well, Ginny, I want to thank you so much. The new album is available, am I correct? It's available now, Devil at My Heels, for those who want to get their hand on it.
Yes.
Okay. And vinyl, yes, vinyl for the record yet, or is that still forthcoming?
Still something we're considering.
Yeah, they get CDs, if
people like... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, that does get expensive, you know, to do certain, you know, you got to have a certain number to run those.
Sure, yeah. CDs are available this month from the Blue Alon website, bluealon.com, and Amazon. In the next 3 weeks, they'll be available for shipping. And anyone that purchases one on the Blue Alon website gets the free digital version as well.
Awesome. Well, Ginny, I want to thank you so much. I wish you continued success, and hopefully we'll see you before long, you know, at a club or theater near us, or heck, a giant arena, depending on who you're coming with or what you're doing. But it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, you too, John. Thank you.
Again, Ginny Luke's new album, Devil on My Heels, is available now. And also to remind you, Kansas will be at the Benedum Center on December 11th, and the Smithereens will be at Jurgles on December 18th for the X Out Cancer Benefit for the Mary Lemieux Foundation. So, hope you enjoyed this. Appreciate you sticking around for kind of a mammoth dose. This will be the final episode of 2024. I want to thank you all for making it a great year for us. You can visit us at IronCityRocks.com. We're available on all the podcast hosting sites. Also, social medias are all Iron City Rocks. And we'd love to hear from you, ironcityrocks@gmail.com. And a little reminder, as we head into the early parts of December, it's getting time for the Iron City Rocks Pittsburgh Music Award nomination. So be on the lookout for that on all of our social medias. Again, a reminder, these are not picked at all by the staff at Iron City Rocks. We simply are the platform for people to nominate and vote bands that they like. So if you're interested in a local band or in a local band, this is your chance to get the word out about your band for nominations and for voting. So we'll have all the details of exactly what's needed when we post that, but be on the lookout for that. Want to thank you all, wish you a wonderful holiday time and a great ending to 2024. 2025 already looking amazing, with announcements of things like AC/DC, Billy Joel. This season for the Star Lake will just be exploding soon. So many, many great shows in 2025 to look forward to, as we look forward to bringing you information about any and all shows we can. So until then, have a blessed new year.